This is Holly Solis interviewing Seth McManus, right? On April 7th, 2015, for Undocumented Voices. So just to start, can you tell us where you're from and where you've grown up?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, the metro region, but not specifically in the city, so about 30 minutes outside the city, a small town called Rock Hill, South Carolina. And, you know, people that know Charlotte geographically, it's right on the state line. So people sometimes get confused, are you from North Carolina, are you from South Carolina? But I am actually from North Carolina, where I was born, but I grew up in South Carolina. So, I lived there till I was about 18, and then I moved to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where I went to college, Coastal Carolina University. It's a 4-year liberal arts institution, and so I spent about 5 years in that area, and then I moved to Miami, Florida for a year where I worked as a residence hall coordinator, and then I ended up here at ASU about 4 years ago for grad school, and then worked in housing here for 3 years, and currently working and study abroad here at ASU.
How is living in Arizona different than living in Miami or in...
I think, Miami is a very unique place because it's pretty much an international city. So you see a lot of people from, especially the islands and the Caribbean and really all over the world, which was very different coming from Carolina. Because a lot of times I'd go into the grocery store and I'd be the only native English speaker in the area of town that I lived in, or there was a large Haitian population. And even culturally, it was very different because, you know, if you're at a stoplight and you don't immediately go when the light turns green, they start honking at you, kind of like how they do in Puerto Rico or, you know, your other areas in the world. But Arizona and South Carolina are kind of unique, I think, because the political environments are very similar between the Carolinas and Arizona. Both areas are really fast growing, and so that's changing the political dynamics within the state. But then you still have these really conservative streaks within the states that are long-standing, right? So those people who have been there for a long time tend to be like older white men that still have the political control, but the masses and the people that live within the state are changing. So you have these changing dynamics. I joke a lot that Arizona is kind of like the Carolina of the West Coast, because they're always in the news. Even when I did my study abroad in 2010, I was in Costa Rica, and that's when SB 1070 was a huge deal here. And it was crazy because even outside of the country at that point in Costa Rica, they were still talking about SB 1070 in Arizona, outside of the U.S., and there were so many other things going on in the world, but that's what people were talking about, and they wanted to know what was going on. Like, why is this a big deal in Arizona? Why are they trying to pass this legislation? And it was interesting being outside of the country when that was happening, hearing people's take on it, actually being in a Spanish-speaking and Hispanic-speaking area. It was interesting to hear their perspectives, because it actually made me understand that they are issues related to immigration in many countries around the world, Costa Rica being one of them as well, because I was surprised my host mother, being Costa Rican, I thought she might have a different take on it, as far as I thought she might be against it, because being a dark-skinned woman, maybe coming to the U.S., feeling racially profiled because of a bill like that. But she actually was in support of the bill, which really surprised me. So it gave me the opportunity to kind of ask questions and learn about why she thought that that bill was a good thing for Arizona. And it come to find out she had an issue with a lot of the Nicaraguans that were migrating into Costa Rica. And she kind of related the Mexico and U.S. relations to Nicaragua and Costa Rica, as, you know, Nicaraguans tend to be darker skinned as well. So you can kind of see a difference in them versus Costa Ricans. And she kind of had a similar take on it as a lot of Americans tend to have on immigration in the U.S. So I thought that was interesting that there was a lot of parallels, even though it was a different country that I was in.
How was your experience of studying abroad? What did you bring back from that made you look at immigration and everything? Did that bring? Was it any different when you came back?
Oh, yeah. I think that's actually a really good question, because I didn't think it was going to impact me the way that it did. But then when I came back from it, I was only there for a month, which is a short-term program, but it was really impactful because I learned a lot just by going in trial and error, being in an environment that I didn't know I was going to be really uncomfortable in. And I got there and learning that, you know, growing up in the South and never really having left the South, you know, flip-flops are normal. You just wear that every day, you know, shorts and flip-flops and boat shoes and tank tops or polos, and you're good. But I wore that stuff in Costa Rica and people really looked at me weird, and I had never been on the other side of that. I had to ride the bus to school every day. And when I got on the bus, I was wearing flip-flops, and people actually laughed at me, which I never had experienced that. Like, I was like, wait, no, this is cool. Like, how can you be laughing at me? I'm wearing rainbows. These are expensive, right? But they laughed at me, and they kind of made fun of me, and I was also the only white guy on the bus, like American, English-speaking white guy. They're white Costa Ricans as well, but what they would call, like, Americano or gringo. And that experience of feeling different than other people, or even I found myself towards the end of my time trying to assimilate to their culture, which now working and study abroad, I know is actually very normal for students to do when they go abroad, to try to buy clothing to then assimilate to that population. And I found myself going and actually picking up like some Costa Rican trends and buying some Costa Rica branded things and trying to assimilate to that culture, because that had kind of become my new normal. So when I came back to the US, I kind of brought that with me, because I remember what those experiences felt like of the times that I was kind of like looked at differently, or what I thought, how I thought things should be was not how they were there. And that was okay. Like, I kind of learned a new way of doing a lot of things. So it kind of, it really did change the way that I look at things.
Did you do that study abroad before you started working with Dream Zone?
I did. Yeah, I did. So I did that as my senior year in undergrad, and then I didn't start working with Dream Zone until probably about a year and a half ago.
Okay. So how did you get actually, could you explain what Dream Zone is first?
Yeah, so Dream Zone is an ally certification program for faculty, staff, and students here at ASU is how it started. It's grown to be a lot more than that, but it basically is trying to educate our local community here at ASU about issues facing undocumented students, but specifically Dreamers, in regards to how to navigate the higher education setting. So a lot of times these students face a lot of the same challenges that first generation American college students, native born college students face, which would be like a lot of barriers, because maybe if they are the first one, they don't know what they don't know is what we kind of say. So they don't know what the financial aid office, they don't know what a FAFSA is, they don't know that they have an academic advisor, they don't know how to register for classes. So trying to help those students navigate that. But then the other barrier is the financial piece that undocumented students can't complete a FAFSA. So basically training staff on how to be cognizant of those issues that these students are facing, and if an undocumented person were to come out to them, knowing how to address that, and in the sense of supporting them, how to connect them in with resources. I think one of the most valuable things that Dream Zone did is it created a network of allies here at ASU for people to network amongst departments, which I thought was a really valuable resource, because what could happen is if someone disclosed in TRIO program that they were undocumented, for instance, I then could be in contact when I was working in housing with the TRIO person if the student was okay with them sharing that disclosure of how to navigate other areas of the university. So they might could call over to their contact in the study abroad office, which also completed the certification and understood the issues surrounding Dreamers that they were facing, how to help them best navigate that. So it created a really strong network of allies here at ASU, and it actually has grown to be so much more than that. So now it's kind of creating a national network of allies.
How has it created that national network? So who has reached through that?
Yeah, so I think several of the facilitators have, within, I guess, their focuses of control, have gone and kind of spread Dream Zone in their different areas, attending national conferences. So Jesus Cisneros and Davia Rodriguez, they're the original founders. And they've gotten other facilitators on board, but they still are the ones out championing it most. I know one of the things that we worked on was Davier wanted to go to the Clinton Global Initiative University, and we, Jesus and I, led the effort to get people out to vote at ASU for it. Basically, the program was in what was called a Sweet 16 bracket, and the winner would get recognized at the conference and get to meet Bill Clinton and get the recognition and the prestige. And so we worked here to lead like a get out the vote effort to bring on one piece was getting the awareness out about what Dream Zone was. But the other piece was, could you please submit a vote for Arizona State University for entrepreneurship for us to get this recognition? And so we all worked within our different networks. So Jesus was more on the academic side. And then I had housing covered and more of like educational outreach and student services, and working with them to try to get out the vote. And then also ourselves setting alarm clocks in the middle of the night to get up and vote to make sure, because you could vote like multiple times. So we were just basically not sleeping during that time and trying to get as many votes as we could. In each bracket, you know, the voting would restart. So when you would win, it would be like a 24-hour bracket. And so whichever team got the most votes would move on to the next level. So each time it kept resetting, but we went on to win that. We didn't find out until they announced it at the conference. So we were like watching it and we were really excited. But then Bill Clinton was now talking about Dream Zone. And then you've got like 1,000 college age undergraduate change makers basically there listening to what this is. And so I think that sparked a discussion, but things like that. So going to these conferences, and they went to APA conference, I think in Hawaii, and presented things like NASPA, which would be the higher education conference, networking with the universities here in Arizona, so NAU and Tucson, getting involved with Teach for America. So kind of expanding even outside of just higher ed, but maybe into K-12. So just using networks that you've made.
Does NAU and U of A have a Dream Zone workshop?
I don't know at what level they are currently. I know that they both have expressed interest in starting one, and I know that facilitators have gone up to Flagstaff to work on things, and I know that there has been contact with U of A, but I think Davier and Jesus will probably be the most versed on that.
So what do you do for Dream Zone?
So I help facilitate the 4-hour certification course, basically upon request. So a lot of times when Jesus and Davier will kind of lead the structure of it as far as setting up the schedule. And then if there's one that needs covering, a lot of times they will outreach to me to see if I'm available to help cover that. In my old department, I was able to use time during the workday to present, and basically I had more of a flex schedule. So I was able to go, a lot of times the certifications are during the workday. So they would be like maybe 8 a.m. to lunchtime or lunchtime to 4 p.m. So I was able to use my time at work to go and do that. Now that I'm in a more formal office setting and study abroad, and they're just, the reality is that there isn't as, it's harder to sell the value of it in study abroad because there's so many more barriers for an undocumented student to study abroad than there was for them to live in housing, that I think I have a hard time convincing the department to allow me to use office time to facilitate that. So I haven't facilitated any in the last 7 months because of my career change, but I would be able to if it was outside of work. But basically, if they have a session open, they will outreach to me, see if I'm available to help facilitate. And then I typically serve in the capacity as a co-facilitator. But one of the dynamics I think that I do bring is being an ally and not having been someone that was personally affected by being undocumented. I think I love the dynamic of presenting with Davier or Jesus because they have very unique insights growing up in Hispanic areas. And, you know, the ties that they have and the friends that they have are not the way that I grew up. So I think we bring very different insights into it. So I really enjoy presenting with them because I feel like I have something that I can bring to the table that's a different perspective. And I think it makes the sessions a little more dynamic.
So to be a facilitator, do you do research on resources, on the history of the movement? What exactly does that pertain?
So for me, I just expressed interest. They both know me personally, and they know that I am basically a news junkie. I watch the news for 3 hours a day, and I like to read articles. And I'm really interested in ideas and how, like, social change happens and what motivates people and what's happening politically. Because a lot of times, a lot of political issues are really intertwined as far as, like, you know, how does the minimum wage hike tie into education cuts, which then tie into undocumented people. All of these things are these hot topics that are going on in politics. They all seem to have a common root that they come from. And so I think just knowing me personally, they knew that that was something that I was really interested in, and that they knew that I kind of had a level of competency because of that, that I think most people probably don't have because they're just not, it's not a hobby for them as much as it is for me. But for me, the preparation was getting the information that they had built. So they built Dream Zone. It was their baby. And then they kind of showed me what they had. And then I kind of even gave feedback on what I thought. So like one of the things, they have a vocabulary section. And one of the things that I noticed wasn't on there that I actually heard tossed around a lot in politics was this term like sanctuary cities. And so what that is actually cities that, contrary to federal or state law, try to create environments that are more welcoming for undocumented people. So, and it kind of sometimes can be used in a pejorative way, I think, is like, oh, there's a sanctuary city. We don't want to be like Los Angeles. They're a sanctuary city. They condone these illegals coming into the country and using government benefits, and they remove barriers for undocumented people. So therefore, people that are undocumented migrate to those cities because it's a more welcoming environment versus a hostile environment, which some states try to create to drive undocumented people out. So that was an example of something that I noticed that was missing that I tried to Like, oh, have y'all thought about adding this? But a lot of it was they went through and they were like, these are the things that we have in the PowerPoint. Let's talk about slides that we can talk about. Which, what will you talk about? What will I talk about? And then some of the things I wasn't aware of. So it did require a little bit of research on my part, just reading them. So the political things I knew more so, but then the student narratives and learning some about the undocumented panel that they work with, where they bring in undocumented students, typically about one, two, or three of them, to speak to the group. Getting to know them personally and understanding their stories and kind of how to coordinate that, although they typically do coordinate that, but it's nice knowing them by name when I show up or having a history with them.
So who is Dream Zone for exactly?
Well, I think it's a very inclusive certification course, so there's no one that it would not be for. I think it has something for everyone in it. That's one of the things that drew me to it. I was actually talking about this last night to Davier. I was telling him one of the things I really love, because he was asking, how do you reach people that don't really care about an issue, right? Like, they think that their way of thinking is right and they don't really aren't open to new information. And that's one of the things that I think is really great about Dream Zone, is there are a lot of people that finish Dream Zone and they come in thinking one way and they may not leave agreeing with what they've heard, because all we do is try to present the information to them in an unbiased way. We try to make it about student success and they can do what they want with it. It's about creating safe environments for those students. But I think a lot of times you can't help but see and sense the political elements as they tie into it, especially when we get into the political environment surrounding things like deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, or some of the legislations. Even, you know, South Carolina has some of the toughest in the nation. So being from there, and then I can kind of share my experience. But I think it's really for anybody, because the actual certification, I feel like it changes the way that people think, regardless of where they're coming from. So for instance, one of the times that Jesus led a session, and I wasn't even at this session, but it stuck with me when he told me the story that someone from the Veterans Center came in and they were trying to get certified in, just for work in the office. And they went in, and when she left, she's like, I just want to let you know that, like, this really impacted me, and me and my husband are going to go home and have a talk about this tonight, because it changed the way that I thought about immigration in Arizona, because there's so much more to it than what I was thinking about. There's more elements and it's more complex than what I had originally thought. And so I think that Dream Zone in that regard is a really great tool for serving as an agent of change here to change the way that people think about an issue, and if nothing else, to get them questioning what they think about it. Because the goal isn't to, like, indoctrinate them and make them agree with everything that we think, but it's more along the lines of, this is kind of the environment right now, and what do you think about this, and how do we remove some of these barriers and create safer spaces for students? So I think in that way it's very inclusive. And we have students that come as well. So a lot of times we'll have students that are really passionate about the calls, and they're not student leaders, they're not employees, they're not faculty or staff, but they just want to participate, and they're always welcome to. And like I said, we're trying to expand it outside of just ASU. So not just to other four-year institutions, but also community colleges in the works. There is some debate right now, I think, even among Dream Zone of the direction, because we are trying to spread so much. And then it's like, well, what are our common goals? What is kind of our audience of who we really want to be reaching? So that's actually a discussion, I think, that's going on right now with the future of Dream Zone, because it doesn't really have a set home here at ASU, because it was started by students. And students come and go, and we graduate, and people that work at the university move on to new career paths. So I think right now that is part of the discussion, is kind of, what is the common purpose? Who are we going to really target and serve? Although we're open to everyone, what is our target audience moving forward? And where is the home of Dream Zone, kind of?
What resources do you give to undocumented students? Do you do that, or is it just the certification for faculty and staff?
I know that that's been another debate, I think, within as far as what the role of Dream Zone is. Of course, like I said, we're open to everyone, and I think it has kind of morphed into that support for undocumented students, because they see that as a visible support system here at ASU, and especially in a place where there aren't a lot of visible support networks. I think that there have been a lot of undocumented students that have kind of latched onto it. But on the flip side of that, because of the environment here in Arizona surrounding undocumented students, the reality is there aren't that many at ASU. I think I was hearing that there was about 50, and how they retrieved that data was just looking at students that graduated from ASU high schools that were paying out-of-state tuition. Was the only metric right now. So there could be more than that, but that was the metric that they were using. So out of 75, 80,000 enrolled students, only 50. So it is serving as, for those 50, a support network. But I think a lot of times those students will serve on our panel if they feel comfortable doing that. But they'll develop personal relationships with some of the facilitators, and we kind of will take on more of like a mentorship role. Or I know there's one student that we've helped. She's actually, because she's paying out-of-state tuition, even though she is a high school graduate of Arizona and grew up in Arizona, because of her undocumented status, even though she's a honors student in Barrett, she's paying out-of-state tuition. And so she's paying double, and she doesn't have a FAFSA. She's not eligible for any student loans. And so one of the things that we've done is try to help her raise funds, find money in different departments in the university that can be eligible for scholarships that may not require a social security number, private scholarships, things like that, and even sometimes donating some of our own money to try to help her reach that goal. So I think more informal relationships, but definitely creating that formal network as well, because we have the online database, so students can actually search online and find a name of someone in each department that is Dream Zone certified. So aside from just the placards, there's the electronic resource of being able to get online and search for that.
Is the story of the young lady who's paying out-of-state tuition, is that mm-hmm. typical of most, is her story typical of most undocumented students that you've met?
I think, well, it is of the ones that I've met, but that's a discussion right now, even within, I think, the ally and community for undocumented students, is because there's these stereotypical dreamers, which is kind of what's happened, is because people are trying to create change and to create discussion around this topic. People have gone and kind of picked the cream of the crop of the dreamers. And so this perception has kind of been created of like, oh, well, all of these dreamers, they're all like A students and they all want to be doctors and lawyers and engineers. And they are being, you know, they're having to pay out of state tuition. And these are all the barriers. But the reality is there are some of everyone, right? There's students like myself that would be considered average, you know, a 3.0 student, or, you know, even students that just want to go to community college. They may not want to go to a 4-year institution, but there are tons of students out there. It's really shocking to me, because when I think about the fact of even the barriers that they face, you know, as far as talking with a lot of the undocumented students that I've met, when I even found out and I meet them and they tell me that they just finished 2 years at the community college, I think, wow, like that's pretty amazing, because I don't know that I could have done that. You know, I think about I've completed graduate school, but if I had to pay and work two jobs, pay out-of-state tuition and go to a community college while trying to support my family and trying to do all these other things, barriers that I didn't have, I don't know that I could have done it. So I have a lot of respect for them when I find that out. But I think that the undocumented experience in Arizona particularly, and in many states, is unique. I'm just going to vary from state to state, because state policies dictate the education policy. So California, even though they're right next door to us, has a very different policy on undocumented students versus what Arizona is doing. But I do find it typical that a lot of dreamers that I meet are really hardworking. I think there could be some bias in that, because I work in the higher ed setting, so I'm going to be exposed to students that are trying to pursue higher education here at ASU, versus when I go into Phoenix and I'm volunteering with organizations for undocumented people there, I'm meeting a completely different demographic of people that may not have even thought or have access to higher education. So I guess I recognize the bias because I'm meeting them in a university setting, but the ones that I do meet here are really, really driven. And I mean, I think that's kind of the heartbreaking part of the whole thing, right? Is that you're meeting these students and they are doing everything they absolutely can do to be successful, but they're not able to achieve what they're trying to achieve. So I think it's kind of put in people's heads this American mentality of, well, you can be anything you want to be, right? Or, you know, like there's nothing can ever stop you if you have a goal. But for these students, when you talk to them, they're at a dead end. You know, they've done literally everything they absolutely can do. They're out like doing car washes on the weekend, they're fundraising, they're applying to every scholarship they can find, they're networking, they're making straight A's in the courses that they're in, they're working a job on the side, they're doing all of these things, and they still just, their goal, they can't get there, right? So even if they graduate, there was a student in a documentary, he was an ASU student, and he had graduated from ASU with a degree in engineering, so high demand filled, which most students that they graduated and they were a citizen would graduate and make probably at least $70,000 a year, a pretty decent salary. But this guy had graduated, he was undocumented, and he was here on a scholarship that wasn't funded through the state, so he was able to pay for his whole education here for all 4 years, and graduated with honors with an engineering degree, which is really hard to do if you know anyone in engineering. It's a really difficult field to go into, I think, and to make grades like that and graduate. And he graduated from ASU, has this degree, and wants to contribute, but can't, because he's undocumented, so no engineering firm is going to hire him. And right now, according to the documentary, after a year or two out, he was working with his dad doing brick masonry in Mesa. So he's out building houses and stuccoing houses with his engineering degree simply because he's not documented, and there's no path. There's no pathway for him. So that's the frustrating thing, is listening to these students. I'm a solution-driven person, so I want to sit down with these students and try to help them. But I think that's the really hard part, is that a lot of the students that I do meet here at ASU that are doing everything they possibly can do to be successful, and they want to contribute, and they want to be a part of the country, and they want to do something with their lives that's bigger than just themselves, and they're meeting all these barriers, and they're literally at a dead end. But I think talking with them and getting to know them is one of the things that I've used to really try to influence people that I know, even just family members of mine coming from a really conservative family. I take those stories home with me, you know, and I kind of put them out there, and I question people, because there are a lot of misconceptions about undocumented people, a lot, and I try to dispel them by using some of those stories, because I didn't grow up knowing them, now it is personal to me because I've met them and I've heard their story, and I want people to know that they're there, you know, because a lot of times you would walk past them because they're an invisible population and you wouldn't even know that. So I do try to get their stories out as much as I can, so that people, I think more along the lines of, know that they're there, because I don't know that I would have if I hadn't have met them, because immigration in general is really tricky. And it's funny, my sister just married a guy from London, from Britain, and they're going through the immigration process. And it was a great time for me to be able to have a conversation with my family about immigration as it relates to undocumented people, but specifically Dreamers, because all they've done is complain about the process. And it really hit a nerve with me, because I'm like, wow, like, what a privilege you have to come from Europe, to come from England of all places, to be white, to be able to immigrate here and just assimilate to the culture, have people want you here, right? You go out in public, people love your accent, they welcome you. But imagine if you had been from Mexico, or even from Central or South America, and you had married my sister, and you now are Spanish speaking, people would probably say things like, go back to Mexico, or be very unwelcoming to you. So what a privilege you have to come here, and on top of that, to be able to marry an American. And so when he complains, I remind him, you're on the fast track. So in the scheme of immigration, to marry an American and be from Europe, wow, that's the quickest way to do it. So he's complaining about a 6-month process, or all the forms he has to fill out, or, you know, the fact that it costs them $2,000. And I think about a lot of Hispanics that I know that are going through the process, and they're paying way beyond that. They're waiting way longer. They're filling out way more forms, and they're being treated very differently. So I think because of that, because of what's happened with my sister and who she married, it's created a dialogue in my family about immigration. I probably got way off from your question.
Just to go back just a little bit, do you either help out, or do you attend any other organizations in the area that deal with undocumented youth?
Not as much as I would like. I've been to an organization called QUIP, which is for queer undocumented people in the Phoenix area. It's like a local chapter. But I was not able, because of time constraints in my job. When I was in housing, I had a lot of non-traditional hours, so I haven't been able to connect in as much as I would like. So it's pretty much right now just Dream Zone, and then what I know about QUIP through Jesus and Javier, because they're both really involved with that organization, and they're more about immigrant rights as a whole, so more public policy and things like that. But I try to serve in a different capacity, I guess more informally, by advocating, like, within my job here at ASU, and within different department networks that I have. For example, one of the things that I've done, so it's not a formal organization, but through my job, an opportunity came along to attend a webinar on how to support undocumented students in the field of study abroad. So then I was able to kind of tie it back into my job and serve as an ally in my position without it seeming political, right, and having relevance. So I had requested to attend the webinar. It was actually over lunch, so it wasn't an issue. They were like, sure, of course, like, go find out what other study abroad offices are doing. And so I actually found out that University of Texas Austin has they have listed a section for Dreamers and undocumented students to study abroad on their website. So talking about that visible support element. And they talked about the barriers and how they've helped students and the fact that they have had an undocumented student study abroad and how they were able to do that. So the student actually had to be documented or have a legal, like a deferred action status to be able to go. But they talked about the unique experience of being an undocumented student and a DACA recipient and going abroad and that visible support piece. So basically I took a lot away from that hour and a half webinar and I brought that back to my department. And we're kind of in discussions now because it's something that I'm trying to move forward. We're about to unveil a new website. I don't have it on there yet, but I'm hopeful that I can convince the director that it is something important to have because I think being the size of ASU really wants, they say they want to be on the cutting edge of things. So I tried to tell them, like, if you want to be innovative and you want to be on the cutting edge, this is where you need to go. This is one area that needs to be addressed and have that visible support out there for those students. Because visibility is so big when you're dealing with an invisible population. You don't know who those students are. So you need to be very visible so that they can see you because you're not going to be able to go and find them. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to relay to them that, you know, we have LGBTQ students on there. We have a veterans section. We have an ASU online section. I think it's just a natural fit to then have a Dreamers or an undocumented student section on there. And if nothing else, for them to have that information available. But hopefully so that they can connect in with staff as well. And we can connect them to other resources using that network.
That's great. So you said that you, have you hit any really big barriers trying to get your office to start doing that? I know you said that you're trying to convince somebody, but were there any big barriers?
I think it's hard in study abroad because the answer from administration has been, I'll leave it kind of ambiguous because I want to keep my job, but the answer from administration has been more along the lines of that we don't have undocumented students studying abroad because you have to have a U.S. passport, or if you have a passport from another country, you have to have a visa. So it's a process that would be nearly impossible for undocumented students until DACA came along, which was in, I think summer of 2012. But even that was an executive action. So it's political. It could change depending on who wins the presidency next and what their vision is for that process. It only lasts for 2 years. So I think the discussion prior to DACA was we're not serving this population. Because of DACA, it now is possible technically for those students to study abroad, but it's not something, they're different than our other populations for study abroad because we wouldn't be specifically targeting them. For documented students, it would kind of be like, oh, you need to study abroad for your academic program. Well, then the first question will be, is there anything you could do to fulfill that requirement without going abroad? Because the advice from institutions that are helping DACA recipients is that we should not be encouraging those students because there is a risk that they may not be able to get back in the country. Because as with a lot of things, it kind of depends on who you run into when you're going through immigration. So some students have no issue and some can get detained or some may have issues because the people that they're going through the process with may or may not be aware of being documented and what that process is. And they actually have to apply for another special form. The name escapes me at the moment, but they have to apply before they leave to be able to re-enter, and they may not know what that form is. So there's still a lot of barriers, so they still don't want to target necessarily undocumented students as a population to encourage to go abroad, but more along the lines of to have those resources there if an undocumented student walks in the office and they know they want to study abroad and that's what they want to do and they understand the risk associated with it. We then have the resources to serve that population. So it's different than other students where we're really out there trying to encourage all students to have this experience and go abroad and find scholarships and find a way to make it happen. But I think that the main barrier is that prior to DACA, we weren't serving those students. And so I think in the leadership size, it's, well, if you're doing this on the clock, right, so to speak, we're investing resources for our department into this, and resources, we need to be using those wisely, especially with the, I guess, the political environment around education and budget cuts and, you know, sometimes the vilification of education, you know, and the efficiencies of it. So I think we're being more cognizant of how we spend our time during the workday. So to take a half a day out of the office to go work on something that is not going to have an impact to increase our enrollment numbers or to serve students at ASU that are studying abroad or potentially going, I think that's kind of the thought process behind that. But I think now that DACA is here, I went to our director and I laid out, and I said, look, like UT Austin has all these great resources for Dreamers. Why can we not do that? So I think it's more, it was a more of a passive discussion, so it wasn't a formal one. So we haven't gotten a direct answer yet or talked about how to move forward on that. But it's something that, you know, a lot of times in the summer is when we do our evaluations as far as like where the department is and strategic vision and plan and things like that. And I think that's going to be a good time to discuss that. The webinar was only about a month or two ago. So we haven't had time really to implement those changes. So when summer rolls around, I'm hoping that we can at least have a dialogue about it and understand why it can be important. And I'm going to try to help people in my office see the value of it, because I think that that is sometimes the challenge, is helping departments see the long-term value in this, because a lot of times departments have a lot of strategic visions and there's a limited amount of resources and a lot of goals that they want to achieve. And so they have to find a way to do a lot with a little. And I think that that's the kind of the debate amongst a lot of departments, not just mine, is how do we do a lot with a little, in the sense of like, where do Dreamers fit into that? Well, we have 500 ASU students in another population that need to be served, and we might be serving one or two students. So is this resource as well spent? So I think that's more the challenge, is convincing departments that there is value in it.
Have you had any undocumented students come in and ask about study abroad at all?
I have not, no. Now, to me, I've only been in the role about 7 months, though. And I think it goes back to that visible support piece. So I think if the office is not visibly supportive, I think there are the preconceived notions that if I'm undocumented, I'm lucky to even be here. Maybe this is the mindset, right? I'm fortunate to be here. I don't want to leave because I may not be able to get back in. That's a huge risk for any undocumented person. I think, and speaking with a lot of them live in fear already here. So the thought of doing anything extra. And the other piece of that is, like I was saying about first generation students or low income, low SES students, low socioeconomic status, is that a lot of times they, I think, will feel remorseful for going abroad because they're already having trouble affording that out of state tuition. So the thought of studying abroad and that perceived notion of an expensive price tag, or even though that may or may not be true, we have low cost options that are no different than their tuition here. But that preconceived notion of study abroad is a luxury. And I think one of the things that they have worked on in the study abroad office, though, is in our new marketing materials, make sure that we are including a lot of not just ethnic diversity, but diversity and experiences and people and backgrounds and majors. And I think all of those are starting the conversation about that, because I think the other piece of it is, besides the visible support, is seeing someone that looks like you on an advertisement for something like that. I think that sometimes even those subliminal messages can be really powerful, because even sometimes in my role, when we do our orientations, I look around the room and I see a lot of Caucasian students. And when I think about the makeup of the state of Arizona being over 30% Hispanic, it is something that it just gets me thinking, like, are we really serving the state if we're sending, you know, I don't know what the breakdown is, but it seems predominantly Caucasian Americans abroad, and that they're, what are the barriers that are keeping a lot of Hispanics or other populations out of that process? So I think the visibility is probably the biggest one, but I think there are a lot of other little ones that kind of snowball into a larger, you know, effect as to why.
Mm-hmm. Were you able, I'm going to go back a little bit.
Okay.
But you said that you weren't able to always go to QIP. Were you able to attend any meetings at all?
Yeah, I did go once. Yeah, I did go once. And I've gone to some of their fundraising events, but they do have weekly meetings and they are in downtown Phoenix. And so being here in Tempe, and they're typically around like 5:30 or 6. So sometimes because of timing and things, but they'll host like after hours events. And they have done weekend fundraisers. I've gone to some of those, and I know a good number of the members, but I've only attended one formal meeting.
How was that experience? Can you tell me a little bit about it?
It was interesting. It was a lot different than Dream Zone, because now I'm outside of the higher ed setting. And so, again, it took me kind of back to my Costa Rica experience of being maybe the only Caucasian American in the room, or coming from an area where what was my normal, or what is sometimes even thought of as the normal American experience, was now not, right? So a lot of the people in the room were speaking fluent Spanish to each other, and the way that they interacted was very different than how I'm used to interacting with my friends. And being outside of Dream Zone, it was not anything like Dream Zone. It was a completely different experience, but I enjoyed it. I think I needed to find my space there to feel comfortable. I think it's layered on top of the fact that anytime you're new at something, you have to establish basically feeling comfortable in that space. And so I think it was kind of coupled with that. So I was in a new organization in a room where I didn't really know a lot of people. And then the other piece to that was the fact that it was mostly gay men and women and allies that were also affiliated with either were undocumented or allies for undocumented people, and specifically in the Hispanic community. Although it's open to others, that was what the membership tends to be. And at first, I actually was really surprised at the organization, because I think they're part of a national organization, and they have a lot of really great ideas and network. And they were building a fundraiser there at the meeting, and I thought it was interesting because I didn't know if anyone would attend. I was like, oh, they're going to do this dinner. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like a lot of organizations do this type of stuff and it's not successful, but they're very driven. And I went to the event and I was so surprised at how successful it was. They do one every year that's called Drag for a Dream, where a lot of the members will dress up in drag and they kind of set up a bar there and they'll sell cocktails. And that's one of the ways they make money. And they have like a silent auction, or they'll serve dinner, you know, they'll sell tacos and things like that, like things that their families make really, really good. And they raise a lot of, I don't know how much they're raising off it, but I went and it was super packed and crowded, and it was like 10 or 20 a ticket, and it actually was a really good show. They have a lot of talent there. So it was neat to kind of piece together the disconnect between how I felt after leaving the meeting and what my preconceived notions and ideas about it were going to be, and then going to the event and seeing that, wow, they really know what they're doing, or they really have a lot of drive.
What was the difference between what do you think the difference was between the event and the meeting that made you feel so comfortable being at the event and not quite so comfortable being at the meeting?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I think, the meeting, it is a more formal setting. So I was sitting in a circle and we did icebreakers, and so we had to talk about things, and I felt like I was being watched a little more, being the new person, and I didn't understand some of the jokes. And when you're in a setting like that and everyone can see everyone and everyone is talking to each other and you don't understand the jokes, or in my case, I didn't understand the language. I mean, sometimes they would just start conducting the meeting entirely in Spanish, which I know a little bit, but I don't know enough to understand the whole meeting. They would forget to have the translator speak. So sometimes the translator would speak and sometimes he wouldn't. But when I went to the actual event, they had more English, actually. So it was like half English, half Spanish. And I didn't feel like I was being watched. I feel like I could kind of partake in things at my own comfort level. So since part of it was a drag performance, I was able to just be a spectator. And I didn't feel like I necessarily had to contribute to something. I felt like I could be more of a silent observer. Whereas at the meeting, I really felt the need to be involved with the process and kind of contributing ideas and being an active listener more so, whereas the event I could be a spectator. So that was probably the biggest difference.
Do you consider yourself an activist?
I wish I were. Yeah, I don't. I think I have a lot of ideas and I like to do a lot of talking, but I don't think I always am able to put them into action as much as I would like. And I have a lot of excuses in my head, I think, as to why I do that, but I think the ultimate goal would be to be more of an activist. I think there's different in my mind, there's different levels of activism. So I think consider myself more of like a visible ally for a lot of causes, but I don't always end up contributing as much as I would like to. I would probably consider myself an activist in comparison to a lot of people that I know. I think it depends on your reference point for that sometimes, you know, like if people that are legitimate activists, maybe paid, or people that actually do a lot of time volunteering, I don't know that I would consider myself an activist in comparison to that. When I think about a lot of the students that I work with here at ASU, or my family members, or even a lot of my colleagues and different jobs in housing and around the university, I would consider myself a lot more political than they are. And I do have some time of year that I actually do volunteer some. So I do, like I volunteered with the organization called Mi Familia Vota, and it's a Spanish organization that helps to get people basically to the polls. It's supposed to be nonpartisan, so it's not affiliated with any candidates, but like for instance during the 2012 election, I was a van driver for them. So just for that day, I drove people to the polls. Anybody that needed to ride, they would just call this hotline, because it was a Hispanic organization, and they were involved with trying to get Hispanics to come out and vote. Most of the people that I drove were Spanish speaking as their native language, but we would just drive them to the polls. We wouldn't tell them who to vote for or anything. We would just simply give them a ride and drop them off there and wait outside the polling place while they went in, because we weren't allowed to go in with them. But I actually found myself in that experience. It actually showed me, I think it brought up, it was interesting because through that, even though it was nonpartisan, we were in poorer areas of Phoenix, and I really saw the effects, what I feel like, of voter suppression, where I went to go vote. So I'm here in Tempe, and I lived on campus at the university, so I went to vote, and I just walked in. I didn't really have to wait in line. I went right in and dropped my ballot off and left. And they greeted me, and there was no issue. But now I'm at a polling place in South Phoenix, a predominantly Hispanic area of town, and the lines are like out the door, and there's no person at the polls directing people as to what to do. So people were lining up actually with their mail-in ballot already filled out. They didn't know they could just go inside and drop it in. There was no one out there telling them. So actually, we were helping to kind of answer questions and direct people, not in a partisan way, but just about the process to, you know, if you already have your ballot filled out, you can take it in and drop it off. You don't have to stand in line. So that was helping to alleviate some of the line, and even people needed assistance, with their ballot, knowing how to, put it back into the envelope, just like very basic things. And you know, if they could get in line, what like identification they needed, could they use this card? Could they use that card? So trying to serve kind of in a role that I feel like the poll workers should have been, but I don't have a reason as to why they weren't. But I did recognize that it was a very different experience than what I received at my polling place. And I was frustrated by that, but I also, we stayed until the polls closed that day there, just helping, driving people and also staying at that polling place and just helping from the street, actually, because the line was so long, it was outside of the building, because there's laws about people being within certain feet of a polling place. So we just stood out on the sidewalk and helped direct a lot of the people that were there to vote on how to do that, because there was no one there outlining that process or assisting people with it.
What got you interested? It seems like you're very interested in Hispanic or Hispanic American issues, like immigration and things like that. What got you interested in that sort of thing?
Well, I'm interested in a lot of topics. Immigration is one of them. Mm-hmm. But I think the underlying premise, the thing that really resonated with me, is that as with a lot of issues, it didn't feel morally right was the first thing. The way that the conversation around Hispanics specifically in the country and the way that that population is treated. Growing up in a really conservative family, in what I would probably consider now a Republican family, three kids, you know, a mom and a dad, all the same parent, a pastor for a dad and a mom that was a nurse. So you're like American Pie traditional family. I think I realized that, one, that Hispanic culture is not that much different than Southern culture. They're very similar. A lot of Hispanics actually tend to be conservatives, which is kind of the ironic thing, I think, about the Republican stance in the country surrounding immigration. And I think that I learned that Hispanic values are actually very American values in the sense of what people think of when they think of what it means to be American, of like working really hard, setting a dream. I mean, a lot of Hispanics come here because they want a better life or they want to contribute, but yet that's lost. And the message is, oh, they're moochers, or they want food stamps, or, oh, they're going to college for free, which is just like, it's preposterous, the things that are being said. And so I think the injustice bothered me, and the message and the misinformation that's out there around that, as with any topic, really would bother me. And it's not right, you know, what's happening. I think that there's like the moral side to it, but there's many ways to look at immigration. And that's something that we talk about in Dream Zone, is there's many appeals to the calls, and some of them are even economic, right? So there's the economic piece of that. You have people here working, a lot of them in lower wage jobs, and they're contributing and they want to be here. So why is there not a path to citizenship for them, or those types of discussions? So I think there are many facets that attract me to that calls. But I think one of the most important one is probably the moral piece. I just feel like there's a lot that's lost in translation with the movement, that I want to try to serve as a very visible ally to have those conversations with people that they might not. I think when I told Davier and Jesus I wanted to be involved with Dream Zone, I think they were more excited than they were with some other facilitators, because they really want more allies. They want people. The reality is that people respond differently to different types of people. And they know that when a Hispanic person is trying to talk to a Caucasian person about the calls, they respond differently than if it's another Caucasian person, or even Southerners. If I'm talking like Southerner to Southerner, there is a difference in that, and the amount of people that we're able to reach and the way they perceive that message and to get that dialogue started. And so I think for me, I really like to talk about, it really drives me to be able to have a conversation with people about what their thoughts are about immigration, and helping them piece those pieces of the puzzle together. Because I know that the way that people feel is the way that, how do I say this? There's a disconnect between what people think of immigration and what is reality. And I know that if I can talk to people about the facts of immigration and what is really happening, that they will change their mind about it. I know that. Even, you know, I have an 84-year-old grandfather, and I was talking to him, and he made a comment, like, I was home over the summer, and he said, well, you know, there's all these Mexicans going to school for free. And there's so many things wrong with that statement, right? But the great thing was I was able to have a really good dialogue with him about it. And by the end of that conversation, he didn't admit that he was wrong or anything, which was fine. But he actually said, you know, I didn't know that. And he just kind of left it at that. And I was like, you know, maybe he'll go back and think about that, and that will resonate with him on down the road, or that will, you know, at least stop him from making those type of comments at the very least. Because I think there is this misconception that Hispanics are here, and as a population, I don't like to generalize people, but that's the notion, that they're here and they're getting a free ride. So then I kind of use that as a segue of, well, like, how are they getting a free ride? Because they can't receive any benefits, and the laws are being designed to make people so miserable that they actually will leave, you know. And I try to talk to them about what that means, you know, why would you pass laws that specifically target a population? Or, you know, this is what it is like, you know, from a Hispanic person's eyes, people that I've talked to, at barriers that they're facing. So I don't remember what the original question was, but I'm way off topic as usual. Okay.
You talk a lot about face-to-face conversations that you have with family members. Is there any other way that you spread the facts about immigration and undocumented youth in other ways?
Yeah, so informal conversations, also through social media. So I think that's another important piece. When I talk about visibility, it's making certain topics trend on Twitter. You know, for instance, like on Martin Luther King Day, I try to connect people's minds. I think a lot of people are celebrating Martin Luther King, but there are a lot of quotes and things that you can look to from his time here when he was prominent and giving speeches that point to immigrant rights as well. And so I use that as a platform on those days to like bring up those discussions about immigration and why that's important. So sharing articles, staying up to date on things, informal conversations. I do want to be more involved with doing more things than conversations, but right now I am more on the informal front with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see. I think that's all of the questions that I have. Is there anything else that you'd want to say, want to talk about?
I know there'll be something after I leave the room that I'm like, I wish I had said. I really would like, I want to be involved with it because I think that there's a lot of room to change people's minds on this issue. I think that, as with the two probably hottest topics in the country right now of LGBT rights and actually legalized marijuana, I feel like are two really hot political topics right now that people are talking about. And I think the third would probably be immigration. And I think that as people begin that dialogue about it, and I think it really starts, you know, you hear a lot of politicians talk about grassroots campaigns. So, right, you can spend millions of dollars on TV ads and that may not translate into votes, but then you'd look at candidates that went and they always will reference their grassroots campaigns, whether it's like President Obama and his really awesome grassroots effort all the way down to local elections. Grassroots is really the thing right now in politics. And I think that in that's kind of what that, well, that definitely is what Dream Zone is. It's a grassroots effort of someone, of two people that saw a population that wasn't being served. And they actually started from a conversation kind of like this interview where they were like, wow, like this isn't right. And then what is ASU doing about this? And then they come to find out there just really wasn't much that the university was doing or that they could do because they're a state institution and all these laws and the political environment. So these two people, Jesus and Javier, really took it upon themselves and were really leaders and got out there and did it. And I'll even admit, I was kind of skeptical when they started it. Because I'm typically an optimist, but I was just like, wow, this is going to be a lot of work. And I don't know if the support is really going to be there. People are going to perceive this to be really political. But they did really an amazing job of building Dream Zone and putting a really solid framework in place that really took the political pieces out of it, you know, for the most part. People that have gone to the session, I think, would agree that it is, tries to be very unbiased and really create a healthy and safe discussion around immigration, which is really how you change people and how you create change in the institution as well. And so many people after the sessions, I think the spirit of Dream Zone and hearing from the dreamers on the panel, the personal stories, the videos, learning about the political environment, the laws, has really changed staff's faculty and students' attitudes towards dreamers. And so you had people that came in that maybe were very nonchalant about participating, or they just came in because they just were curious and left really changed by it. So that's a huge metric because effective training will change their behavior. And so when you have people that are going through just literally a 4-hour, that's all it is, a 4-hour certification, and they're leaving and it's having this astounding impact on their life. And then they're then going out and trying to implement these changes at ASU and nationally and all over the place, really, K-12 and Maricopa Community College and all these different places. It's really amazing to think what two people have accomplished by just this very small grassroots effort. So I've been like, I feel really privileged to have been able to be a part of it. I'm going to continue to serve as a facilitator, hopefully during my time here. But I'm excited to see some of the things that Dream Zone will do moving forward, because that's the other piece to Dream Zone is that immigration right now is changing every day. I mean, one day I was presenting and the Violence Against Women Act actually was expiring that day and Congress had not renewed it because the Democrats had tried to add in a provision to protect undocumented people so that if they were facing abuse, they could call the police without fear of being deported. And the bill actually expired that day in the session, and it was in our PowerPoint slides. So we actually had to talk about that of like, well, the environment's constantly changing, so you have to stay up to date on it. But right now, this law has expired. They went a month later, they renewed it, and they included the protections. They had to strike a compromise. But you know, DACA could change. Things are going to change. And DACA is a Band-Aid. It's not a permanent thing. So, you know, hopefully immigration reform will happen. And at that point, that's going to completely change what Dream Zone means, right? Depending on how comprehensive that legislation is when it happens, because it's only a matter of time when that happens. It's going to completely change what Dream Zone is, and maybe it will. That's the great thing about it, is because it's a grassroots effort, and everybody that's involved, all the facilitators kind of have a seat at the table, and we all kind of talk about the direction and what the pros and cons are. It's going to change, and I could see it changing into more of what we had talked about earlier, where it's more of a student support service, more than a faculty and staff support service. Of course, it will always be inclusive and serve everyone, but the primary goals will change over time as the legislation changes.
Okay. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this interview. So I just need your formal consent to put this on the public online digital archive.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, great. This is Holly Solis interviewing Seth McManus for Undocumented Voices on April 7th, 2015.